From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. 12 feet down, 38 to go. That's the word this morning at Oroville Dam, where water levels have now dipped 12 feet below the lake's maximum 901-foot capacity, with the goal of getting the lake 38 feet lower still before rains begin tomorrow. Overnight, emergency crews continued to work on shoring up that emergency spillway, and nearly 200,000 people remain under evacuation orders. We'll get the latest on the situation at the dam. It's all ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. The high drama at Oroville Dam has lessened for the moment as lake levels continue to drop, but perhaps only for the moment. Feverish action continues at the dam as work crews continue to shore up the eroded emergency spillway before more rains hit tomorrow night. The lake is now dropping at a rate of about 8 feet a day as water continues to be released over the damaged main spillway, with the goal of getting it down another 38 feet further. The great unknown is whether coming rains will fill the lake back up faster than water can be released. But as water levels lower, questions continue to mount over whether the dam crisis perhaps could have been averted. Were warning signals first registered by environmental groups a dozen years ago ignored? And perhaps as important, are there lessons in what's happening in Oroville today that should inform the state's water storage policy overall? We're joined first this morning by Chris McGarrion, who is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's in Oroville this morning, continuing to cover the dam crisis. Chris, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
So good news at the moment, right? The water levels of the lake continue to drop?
Right. So basically, they're letting out so much water through the original concrete spillway that things are stable right now and allowing them to try to make these repairs that they need.
And does that also tie in with how quickly they're trying to work to still repair the emergency spillway? If the crisis has been for the moment averted, is there still a great sense of urgency about trying to repair the emergency spillway in case the situation worsens later this week when the rains arrive?
Absolutely. It's definitely a race against time right now. They're trying to make as many repairs as possible because if that water overflows into the emergency spillway again and those repairs aren't done, they're worried there could be a significant crisis.
And give us a sense of what's going on with those emergency repairs. You know, you see it on the news, you read about it. They're dropping these huge piles of rocks and kind of a slurry mixture, right? It's kind of some sort of almost like trying to cement them in.
It's a massive operation. So basically, they're trucking giant rocks up from a quarry to a staging area and then loading those rocks into the back of dump trucks and into sacks. And the sacks are being carried by helicopters, and then the dump trucks drive across the dam. And they're dumping these rocks in multiple patches along the hillside, which is the emergency spillway. And then they're trying to mix like a concrete slurry to solidify those rocks in place. So basically, you have a huge operation involving a lot of heavy machinery on the ground, in the air, working, you know, to try to patch things up.
And do officials there feel like they are making the progress they want? Is the hillside becoming more solidified?
We're waiting for another update from officials today, and hopefully they'll be able to talk more about that. The repairs began yesterday afternoon, and they were going into the night. So it remains to be seen exactly how much work has gotten done so far.
And how much angst is there at the moment about the weather report? I'm sure people are sort of feverishly tracking what the meteorologists are saying. What's the latest on that? What are people expecting in terms of the amount of rain that may come?
The last we heard from state officials is that there is some concern about the rain, but they're hoping the precipitation won't be too much, and they're hoping that the weather will be cooler, which would reduce the runoff from the snow in the mountains. However, you know, these are estimates, and it's hard to know for sure.
Let's switch for a moment and let you have you also give us an update about where we are with the status of the evacuations. We know that 180,000 or so were ordered to evacuate. Not clear, of course, exactly how many people have evacuated. What's the latest on their status? Any sense of when that evacuation order may change or be lifted?
We've gotten no update on that. We know people who have evacuated are worried and frustrated and hoping to get home. But officials have said they just don't, they want to be careful and they don't want to let anybody home just to tell them to get out again. So we know lots of people are in the surrounding areas, or maybe they just evacuated to higher ground inside of Oroville. In the town yesterday, I could see, you know, a lot of people still driving around, maybe gassing up their cars, checking things out. But still a sense of unease and anxiety about when they can actually settle back in.
And Chris, what are you going to be watching for today and in the days ahead? What are there some kind of landmark developments that you're going to be keeping an eye on?
Mostly the repairs to the emergency spillway, and if they feel comfortable that they can actually use that again. And also to see if there's any further erosion to the original concrete spillway, which could cause even more problems if that were to happen. And then we're all just going to be watching the sky and watching the rain to see what happens there.
Chris McGarian, reporter for the LA Times. Chris, thanks so much for giving us your update, and thanks for your continuing reporting from Oroville.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us as well now are Jeff Mount. Jeff is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, where he closely follows water developments around the state. He's also emeritus professor of earth and planetary sciences at UC Davis. Jeff Mount, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good to be here.
And joining us as well is Paul Rogers, managing editor of KQED's science unit and, of course, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Paul, thanks for being here as well.
Good morning.
So let's talk about kind of both where we are and where we're going, Jeff Mount. First, what is your sort of sense based on how carefully I know you follow these developments in terms of what's going on in Oroville? Does it seem to you now like a situation that is under control?
Yeah, it does. There's reason for hope and optimism here. That is the rate at which they're evacuating. I mean, they made the intelligent choice to use the existing spillway, the main spillway, to evacuate water as quickly as they could. They actually could let more water out through that spillway if they wanted to, but of course they're naturally worried about more damage. But they are lowering the lake steadily, which is the key. And once you get that below the foundation of the spillway, you have a chance to really get in there and get a good look at things and see how robust your system currently is. So I'm reasonably optimistic, especially because these storms that are coming are relatively cool. There's going to be plenty of precipitation, but it isn't going to be a big slug of runoff like we had in those last warm storms that we had that really created the crisis.
And Paul Rogers, as the mood perhaps calms somewhat, although of course there's, I'm sure, great anxiety still in Oroville about those who have been evacuated and want to return home, you sense this sort of shift in the last 24 hours or so, in part because of reporting that you did at the Mercury about this question of whether or not this should have been anticipated. Give us a sense of what we've learned about that, the reporting you did, that certain environmental groups raised questions a dozen years ago about this, and yet we are here where we are today. Give us some background on those sorts of concerns.
Yeah, essentially this is a hydropower dam, and all hydropower dams are licensed by the federal government, an agency called FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and these licenses run usually 30 to 50 years. And so in 2005, the license was basically up, and the process started for the dam to be relicensed. And these processes take years, and lots of different local government, state, federal officials all comment, and so do members of the public and nonprofits. And so three groups, the Friends of the River, the Sierra Club, and the South Yuba Citizens League, all filed a formal motion in 2005, October 2005, basically warning that there were problems with this emergency spillway, because although it has a 1,700-foot long concrete lip along the top, the water, if it ever flowed over the top, would just flow down an earthen hillside, a tree-covered hillside. Their concern, as they spelled it out, was that you could have a, quote, loss of crest control, which means they were worried that the water would go over the concrete lip, the erosion would be so severe, it would compromise the concrete, and it could fall forward and essentially have a huge uncontrolled release of water that would not only cause flooding downstream, but could kill people. They filed that paperwork. They were sort of on a campaign for a couple of years to force the federal government to make California armor that structure. And the federal government, FERC, basically their office in Sacramento, said it's not necessary. The way that the dam was designed in 1968 is sound, and it could handle enormous amounts of water. 350,000 acre feet could flow over that emergency spillway, FERC said, and there wouldn't be problems. Well, we got 12,000 acre feet of water, or about 4% of that amount, flowed over on Sunday, and they ordered the evacuation of 200,000 people. So it turns out that the environmentalists were right, and I think part of the question now that investigations over the next year or two are going to uncover, hopefully, are two things. Number one, why did we build the tallest dam in the United States and not armor the emergency spillway in the first place? Those were engineers working for Pat Brown's administration in the 1960s. Was that just an oversight? I mean, some big dams do have earthen spillways, but some don't. I mean, some have concrete spillways, and some dams that were built before that have concrete emergency spillways. So that's question one. And then question two is, why were they so confident that this thing would never have a problem? How good were the inspections, and why, frankly, did a small group of environmentalists who really aren't experts in dam issues, why did they know more than the experts at the State Department of Water Resources and FERC?
Paul Rogers, managing editor here at KQED's Science Unit, also environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Jeff Mount, let's take a look then at some of the questions that Paul is raising. And first on this question of were water officials correct or incorrect to be confident about what the Oroville Dam could do and the spillway could do? Easy, of course, in this moment to look at this and say, well, no, they weren't right. This is an analysis that always has to be gone through, and you know what you know at the time. What's your sense of that process that they went through?
So, yes, we are in the 2020 hindsight phase of a natural disaster, and this is to be expected. A couple of things I want to say about that and make sure your listeners understand. Every time you drive over the Bay Bridge, you're driving over a bridge which has learned from previous mistakes. I mean, it's macabre to say, but the failure of previous bridges has improved the design of your bridge. So this reservoir was designed in the 1950s and then built in the 60s. It was kind of brute force technology at the time. And it also, and this is something to really keep in mind, part of how they imagined this thing would run was based on the historical hydrology. I mean, they looked at the floods of the past. And there's one thing that's become clear. Our floods are increasing in size and even in frequency. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a shift in conditions, and we should talk a little later about what that means for the future. So at the time, you can call it engineering hubris or whatever you want. They sort of felt that this emergency spillway – by the way, they hate that phrase. They like to call it the auxiliary spillway for obvious reasons. The emergency spillway, they imagined it would never be used. Honestly, I think that they thought, well, we've done enough and we don't have to worry about it. But there's a second aspect that you have to keep in mind that they did, and I'm sure Paul has given a lot of thought to this. You can mitigate risk in these things, and what they do is they calculate what's called the probable maximum flood, and then they basically design around the biggest flood they can imagine, and that spillway was designed to handle a very improbable flood in their view at the time they built it, and that kind of persisted along. We'll probably never use that spillway.
But
now you have.
Yeah, if it was understandable that at the time, with the state of knowledge and state of engineering at the time, that it was built without shoring up the auxiliary spillway, as Paul's reporting suggests, there were questions raised by environmental groups in 2005. There apparently have been some other studies since then, including one that was reported in the San Francisco Chronicle this morning, a report commissioned in 2014 that found, quote, the unlined spillway for the Oroville Dam would likely suffer heavy damage in the event it must be used in a major flood event, unquote. So there have been some things that have come up since in the very recent past that might have been more powerful red flags.
So let me put it in its most basic terms. The people who manage these things are constantly forced with trade-offs. Do I mitigate this risk? Well, to mitigate this risk is going to cost an immense amount of money. And they are always cash-strapped. So to say that they ignored this risk, I think, is disingenuous. I think they were fully aware of this risk. They just didn't want to put up money for it. And it was going to be very expensive. So now it's happened. And that's the – so the unthinkable has actually happened. Or the loosely planned for has already happened. And now is going to come a complete rethinking. And in fact, I will argue here and have argued in the past, the current spillway design is completely inadequate. It isn't just inadequate because of that site. The main spillway is inadequate. It is not large enough to basically move enough water to evacuate the reservoir quickly. And that's a problem on lots of our reservoirs here in California.
And we are going to spend some time talking about this through this hour, about what lessons can we begin to learn and what implications does that have for the overall California water system. But Paul Rogers, do you confer with Jeff Mount's assessment that, you know, it's not so much that this was ignored as it is a question of dollars and cents, that they saw that there might be a problem, but said, we're not going to spend the hundreds of millions that it would take to do what perhaps ought to be done?
Well, I think that's the kind of thing that's going to come out in the investigations. I expect there'll be congressional hearings. There'll be hearings in the state legislature. This is going to be like the San Bruno pipeline explosion with PG&E. This is going to be going on for years. There are going to be huge class action lawsuits. Every email, every piece of paper back to the 1950s is going to be pulled out. And we'll find that out. But, you know, I reported this morning on a filing that the State Department of Water Resources put in with the federal government on May 26, 2006, where they said that the emergency spillway was, quote, a safe and stable structure founded on solid bedrock that will not erode. And they went on to say, quote, there are only 1 to 4 feet of erodible topsoil in the downstream area, and that erosion would not compromise the stability of the emergency spillway. So what DWR was doing, for whatever reason, whether they didn't want to spend the money or whether they were just had this engineering hubris, they were walking around sort of patting everybody on the head, saying, don't worry your pretty little heads. Not only will we never use this, but if we do, it can take enormous volumes of water. We're certain of it. Well, they were the same ones that ordered the evacuation of 200,000 people in 1 hour's notice. And you know, the reason, you know, whether or not they think the spillway is ever going to be used, the reason that dams have emergency spillways is well established over time. Dams have failed in the past. There's horrible examples in American history. Luckily, they don't happen very well because most dams are engineered really well. But from, you know, the Johnstown flood to St. Francis Dam in California in the 1920s, the consequences of losing one of these are so monumental and so catastrophic that you better be sure that the engineering is 100% bulletproof sound. And I know nothing can be 100% bulletproof sound, but there is such calamity if something this size fails. It has to be, and we have to demand rigor, and we have to demand that the money is spent. Because think about this. What this structure is a wall 770 feet tall, taller than the Washington Monument, almost as tall as the Transamerica building. It is as long at the top as the Golden Gate Bridge. It holds back a lake that is 10 miles long, that has 170 miles of shoreline. The amount of water flowing into that lake on Sunday night was 190,000 cubic feet per second. That's more than the volume of flow on the Mississippi River at St. Louis that day. Think about the visual. When you're standing in St. Louis, the river is a mile wide. That much water, that rate, was flowing into this thing with this one wall holding it back. Well, you better hope that the wall is built well, because if that wall breaks and there isn't a warning, it's like a nuclear bomb. You're going to have tens of thousands of people die. So to say, you know, well, we didn't think it would ever be used, that's not good enough for DWR. And I think that Jeff is absolutely right. There's going to have to be major reengineering on this dam, it's probably going to cost $1 billion. And the question is, who's going to pay for it?
Well, and it's also a question, perhaps, Jeff Mount, of whose money is it? Because as I understand it, part of the reason why there wasn't any great eagerness to tackle this problem when the environmental groups, as Paul reported, first brought these concerns up in 2005 was not just whether, not just from the state, but also from the water agencies. Because in California, we have a variety of agencies in play. There are a couple of dozen water agencies that take water from Oroville, right? And they're the ones who also didn't want to foot the bill. So this gets us into how water works in California. Say something about that and about how that part of this puzzle will have to be solved, because there are a lot of players.
Yeah, and this is going to be one of the major unknowns. Nobody likes to pay for this stuff, right? It's always great if somebody else pays for these problems, but we're going to have to foot the bill somehow. So this is part of the State Water Project. In fact, this is the reason the State Water Project even exists, is the construction of Oroville Dam. So it is principally a state reservoir, rather than thinking of, say, Shasta, which is run by the Bureau of Reclamation and is a federal reservoir, which supplies water to the Central Valley Project. So I just can't see any way around it. I think the people who use water from this reservoir are going to probably have to foot the bill for it. I don't see anything. See, in the old days, the federal government galloped to our rescue on these things and came in with large chunks of money. I think those days are long over. So we're going to have to pay for it ourselves. How we pay for it is going to be a big question. The good news is there's 24, 25 million people who use this water. So you've got a ratepayer base. So you can find a way to actually pay for this over the long term.
And these
term.
Are people all around the state, right? A lot of users in Southern California, some here, I think, in the Bay Area.
No,
some
yes,
in the
lots
central...
here in the Bay Area. So this is the you know, be careful of the divide, the Southern California water grab. We use water here in the Bay Area from this system. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley uses it, and obviously L.A. uses it. I mean, the L.A. metropolitan area uses it principally through the wholesaler, Metropolitan Water District. So you're going to – I got bad news. You're going to have to pay for this, California. I just don't think the federal government's going to come to your rescue here. And I don't see how the state legislature necessarily comes to rescue in a big way.
We have to take a break in just a moment, Jeff Mount and Paul Rogers, but – I think you're also suggesting that this is not a one-time only and one-place only issue. We're going to have to look at this question of dam safety and what we want to do to shore up infrastructure, water infrastructure in the state, all across the state.
Yeah, I'm afraid this is going to begin a very, very large – no, actually, this is the silver lining out of this is we're going to take another look at our existing infrastructure. I can tell you we've got weaknesses in it, and it's expensive to fix, but we really have no choice. We have to fix it. So this is going to be quite the dialogue for the next few years, all stimulated by the Oroville crisis.
Dialogue, but we will continue right after this short break. Jeff Mount is joining us, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, along with Paul Rogers, managing editor of KQED's Science Unit and environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News. Paul and Jeff will stay with us after our break. We're also going to get another quick update of what's going on in Oroville from a representative of the Department of Water Resources. We'll hear from him as well right after our break. And we want to hear from you. You can join us with your questions about not only what's going on in Oroville, but whatever questions you may have about what this may imply for the state water system overall. What does it mean? What are your concerns? Join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, what's happening at Oroville Dam? The crisis tension seems to have diminish some at the moment because water levels continue to drop at the lake, but great questions about not only the prospect of repairing the auxiliary spillway in time before more rains arrive starting tomorrow night, but also these bigger questions about what this may portend about our dam situation and the water storage situation in California more generally, our infrastructure more generally. We're joined by Jeff Mount, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, Paul Rogers, managing editor here at KQED Science Unit, and also reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. We hope to get an update shortly as well from from Chris Orrick at the Department of Water Resources. Yesterday, the New York Times editorialized about this, Paul Rogers, and said this is a called what was happening in Oroville a parable on infrastructure, and went on to talk about whether or not, you know, this is sort of emblematic of sort of America's crumbling infrastructure problems. Do you see it this way? Is this sort of the equivalent of the proverbial miner's canary?
Yeah, I think all around California and the United States, we have infrastructure that was built in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. And, you know, that means highways. It means flood control projects. It means dams. It means all the things that we take for granted are always going to be there. And we invested as a society hundreds of billions of dollars to build these dams and to build things like the interstate highway system. And, you know, just like a 50 or a 60 year old person is not quite as robust as they were when they were 10 or 20 or 30, infrastructure gets tired and wears out too. And there's sort of a perfect storm that makes it very difficult to modernize and upgrade all these essential public works. And on the right, conservatives don't like to pay taxes, and we've put in place ways that make it more difficult to raise taxes, like Prop 13. On the left, environmentalists often sue to block projects, and so it's very difficult to get anything built. I'm constantly asked, why don't we just build lots more dams? Well, there are a bunch of reasons. The first reason is that a lot of the good spots are already taken. The engineers with their slide rules back in the 1940s knew how much water came through these watersheds, and they built the dams in the wettest places and the best places. So there are a few spots, but most of the best places are taken. Second, it's really hard to raise taxes. You know, to build a new dam, it costs $3 or $4 billion. So that's that. And then finally, there are a lot of environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, like the Clean Water Act, like the National Environmental Policy Act, and many others, which simply weren't around when Pat Brown and his engineers were putting these things up.
Paul, let me hold you there. We want to return to these really important questions about what this signifies for the future and how we're going to pay for that improved future in just a moment. But we are joined now by Chris Orrick, a public information officer for the Department of Water Resources, and we want to get one more quick update about what's going on in Oroville. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Can you give us any updates about what's happened over the last half hour or so? We heard from Chris McGarian from the LA Times at the top of our show about what the status was. But anything new that you can tell us, particularly in terms of whether or not any decisions have been made about evacuation orders?
No, we're still looking at what we could do to get the people back home. I mean, that's a huge obstacle that we're facing. We want to get them back home as soon as possible, but our number one priority from the start of this is the safety of the community and the residents. We don't want to say, hey, it's okay to come back home and then have another incident happen where we have to evacuate them again. So once we're sure that the safety of the community is there, then we're going to bring people back home.
And is what will determine, make that determination, is whether or not the auxiliary spillway is sufficiently secured? Is that the key determinant in whether or not it will be safe for people to come home?
Well, we had crews out there all night last night, into the day this morning and yesterday afternoon, working on that spillway specifically, ensuring that the erosions that happened, and in particular the large erosion that caused the initial evacuation, is reinforced. So we are using helicopters and heavy equipment to build roads out to the middle of the spillway. So we get crews out there. We're using helicopters to transport large boulders and sacks of material out there. And what we're doing is we're filling those holes. We're going to put slurry into those holes to reinforce them further, so that with the weather that's coming up, we won't see any further erosions that could have a safety impact on that spillway.
But my question is, do you have to make a determination that the auxiliary spillway is secure before you will allow, or the sheriff will allow, people to go home?
Yeah, I'm not going to go into all the factors. There's a lot of factors that are being determined by our engineers and by our incident commanders that are advising the sheriff. But, you know, that determination will be made once we're sure that the community is safe.
Okay. Sounds like it's been going to be some time, though, before that determination can be made. We've been discussing here, Chris, before you joined us, about what this may imply for other dam situations around the state, whether or not there should have been more awareness of this vulnerability. I know you're deep in the thick of the moment there, as you all ought to be. But at this time, are those considerations beginning to be undertaken as well, so that we're beginning to think about and assess whether or not there are other situations around the state that will also have to be addressed?
Yeah, let me make something very clear, and we said this from the beginning, there is no danger to the dam here. And I know we're talking about our spillways, which are off to the side of the dam, but none of the erosion happened into the dam. There's no concern for the safety of the dam. I'm sure just on like any other type of incident that we have, as we start mobilizing to come out here to deal with the effects of it and ensure the safety of the communities, there are always groups that are looking at what's the aftermath and what can we do to improve the situation. So I'm sure those discussions are going on. They're not going on in this area right here. What we're concerned about is making sure we get the factual information about how we're improving the spillway, how we're repairing the erosion that's happened so that we could get people back home.
Okay. Chris Warwick, Public Information Officer for the Department of Water Resources. Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Mount, returning now to this larger conversation about what this suggests for the future. As what ought we be thinking about right now? You know, we've begun to realize now that there is all this infrastructure out there that may be vulnerable. How do we begin to sort through this? What are the questions that we ought to ask? What are the priorities that we ought to focus on?
So we are facing some pretty tough questions. And again, in the fog of war, which is where we are right now, we can always second guess the decisions that are being made during the emergency. But afterwards, when this does finally calm down, we will be asking some pretty important questions. And let me get at one of those most important questions right now. We ask our dams to basically do many things. So Oroville Dam, for example, is a water supply structure. 25 million people drink its water. It is also a flood control structure. It is a hydropower structure. It's a big recreation draw for that area. And it even releases water to support ecosystems downstream, including in the Delta. So these things are often in tension. And so the tension... Basically,
meaning they're not necessarily compatible.
No,
or we have to make decisions about which is more important than the other.
Give you a specific example. And the example is we set aside about a fifth of the space behind Oroville to catch floods. That's probably not enough. Mm-hmm. We certainly discovered that in this go-round. And if we have a greater flood reserve, we have a higher risk of not filling the dam come springtime. And so that affects all the other aspects that are there. So there is a tension and a balance, and it's a balance in risk that they have to do between how much space they leave behind the dam and then how much they want to risk impacting the water supplies. We are seeing – I want to make really clear that the current state of knowledge on climate change suggests that what we've just seen in the last 6 to 7 years is what we're really likely to see more often in the future. That is wetter wets and drier dries. So we're going to have to rethink how we operate our dams right from the get-go. And some of this, if we're going to have greater flood safety, means there's likely to be some cost on the water supply side.
So there are huge public policy questions to be sorted out before we can even begin to figure out where the dollars are going to come from and how we ought to apply those dollars. Let's hear more from our listeners at this point about the sort of questions and concerns that you have. We'll start with Peter, who joins us in San Francisco. Peter, go ahead.
I live in Paradise, California. It's close to Oroville, and I was watching it unfold this weekend. And I agree with what you said about, the DWR willing to spend the money on reinforcing the emergency spillway. It's just, to me, it's not rocket science that when water flows over soil, it's going to erode. That's just common sense. And, this whole thing could have been prevented if they spent the money on it in the first place.
Peter, thank you. Thanks for that observation. You concur, Jeff Mount? Not rocket science? This should have been understood?
It was understood at the time. In fact, when they designed it, they knew that it was going to take that hillside apart. But they thought that was okay. In a big flood emergency, they thought that would be okay. Well, it has proved to be insufficient. We make mistakes, engineering mistakes. This will be viewed as an engineering mistake, and we're going to have to fix it. And we need a new spillway for that dam.
David in San Francisco, or rather Cindy in Menlo Park, joins us next. Cindy, go ahead, please.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is directly related to that response. I read that the response of FERC back in the lawsuit was that it was statistically insignificant.
That's the federal agency involved with the licensure. Yes, go ahead.
Right, that was statistically insignificant, and I wondered what numbers they're actually talking about. That's my first question. And the second comment is, and question related to it is, there was an earthquake that was sort of unexpected up there in the early 70s, and no one has mentioned that. So it was after the dam was designed and built. And I wondered if there had been any increase in monitoring, and given that they just did sort of a visual of the spillway, the line spillway, and that apparently was not good enough to predict this erosion, the hole. I'm talking about the actual spillway, not the emergency spillway. What has been done along those lines?
Cindy, thanks. Thanks for the questions. Paul Rogers' response on the earthquake back in the 70s and what we really know about whether or not the dam is safe, as our water resources person just suggested.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things going on there. So in terms of what Chris from Department of Water Resources said, it is definitely true that the face of the dam, the 770-foot tall dam, is not in danger of crumbling. And that's great. But it's not really the whole picture, because if, remember, we're only about halfway through the winter. There's still two more months of winter. This is a winter where we've had a lot of these atmospheric river storms. If there's a couple of bad things that could still happen here, unfortunately. Right now, it's looking good. But if they have a problem releasing water from the regular spillway, which is damaged, like let's say it starts to erode back up toward the dam, they would potentially have to close the gates of that spillway, or else the gates could collapse as well, and you'd lose the top of the reservoir there. So that's one thing. And if they do that, then you could see the water start to fill back up again and go over the top of the emergency spillway. What they're doing is just putting little patches on and hoping that it holds. But losing the emergency spillway is really not that different from losing the top of the dam. You've just blown a huge hole in the size of a 10-mile-long reservoir. So, you know, people might disagree, but either way, billions of gallons of water are pouring out. And, you know, so I think we have a nice little respite here this week, but they're not going to be able to do any real work on that broken spillway until May or later. So that's the first part. And then just quickly, the part about the inspections, I think it's a great question, and that's going to be part of the investigations. You know, how well did DWR inspect these spillways? Should they have known that there were potential cracks? There's things that can happen over time with spillways and concrete called cavitation, where you can actually have what's like a cavity in your tooth get carved out in the spillway over time because of the pressure of the water. So all these kind of things are going to be investigated, and FERC yesterday ordered the state of California to put together a panel of five independent dam experts within 5 days to start investigating this stuff and look at the fixes and then look at the long-term solutions.
Jeff Mount, we talked earlier about the state of knowledge when this dam was first designed back in the 1950s, but Cindy's question also gets to what our state of knowledge is now. I mean, how well can we really make these assessments?
So our state of knowledge continuously improves. And remember what I said earlier, we do it sometimes through mistakes. And this is a mistake which will improve our understanding. I mind you, nationwide, this issue of spillways and dams is a big deal. The Army Corps of Engineers did a survey some years ago. Thousands of dams have this kind of problem. So so spillways are a big deal. I do want to address the earthquake question, because Oroville was pretty famous, because that was the thought at the time was that was reservoir-induced seismicity, that the actual weight of the reservoir itself had caused an earthquake. It also is the reason we don't have an Auburn Dam today. They stopped construction on the Auburn Dam once this earthquake occurred, and they started to worry about it. That's a big issue, it turns out, in California. There's hardly a square mile in California. It doesn't have a fault in it, and all our reservoirs are subjected to some seismic risk. So that's another aspect that'll be revisited when we look at the overall safety of
these. And perhaps another, Paul mentioned earlier, that one of the reasons we don't build more dams is that all the good spots were,
He's
most
right.
of the good spots were taken. Would that be another reason that would undermine the potential of building dams, that that sort of seismic vulnerability?
Yeah, in some places that'll be the case. We can engineer for that pretty well as long as there isn't an active fault right through the dam itself. And again, that's what did in Auburn Dam. And big Earthfield dams like Oroville are actually pretty stable in earthquakes, so they tend to be well designed for earthquakes. But Oroville's problem, it's a spillway. I mean, it's principally the spillway.
So few comments from our listeners. Rita writes, this crisis is a great loss of credibility for public officials in water management. There has been so much attention on twin tunnels while major infrastructure was neglected. David writes, does damage in the main spillway pose a threat to the stability of the dam, or is it only the emergency spillway that poses a threat? Sort of asked and answered that, I think, Jeff Mount, right?
Yeah.
There's concern about both. It's
right.
not just one
and
or the other.
In the original design of the dam, they did something smart. They put their spillways pretty far away from the actual main structure itself. So, I mean, one can envision how it would impact the main structure, but it is the most far-fetched of those. Really, it's just destroying the hillside where the two spillways are.
And Paul Rogers, Ken writes this question. He says he checked the water flows from Oroville back on February 8th and 9th before the crisis really started, and they were as low as 6,000 cubic feet per second compared to the 100,000 cubic feet per second now. So his question is that level is quite small, so why were the flows cut back so much when the lake level was rising so fast?
It's a good question. I would have to figure out. Let's see. We first discovered the hole on last Tuesday, which would have been the 7th. So if you look at the outflows, the average outflow, I'm just looking at a chart here, the next day, Wednesday, was 11,000 CFS. So that was dialed way back, because I think they were dealing with the hole. But, you know, there was, as the reservoir was filling up, they were letting water out. And this is something that Jeff pointed to. As it was filling up in January, we were all cheering because, remember,
right.
Oroville was sort of the poster child for our terrible five-year historic drought. All those pictures of the houseboats really, really low and the huge, you know, emptiness around it, those went all over the world. And so it was actually good news, and it is good news after a terrible drought when the reservoirs fill up. And, you know, what happened here is Oroville went from being the poster child for the drought to the poster child for what happens when you can get too much water. And I think we, you know, up until the beginning of February, we were glad that it was filling so fast. And then we couldn't get the water out of it fast enough. So all of the things, you know, there's going to be a lot of second guessing. What did they know? When did they know it? But people who operate reservoirs and dams in wet winters have a very high stress job. It's kind of like being an air traffic controller, right? Because if you let too much water out, everybody's going to get mad that, well, you know, we're in a drought. Why are you wasting the water and letting it run to the ocean? But if you don't let enough out and you try to save it all for the summer and you get too much on top of it, then you get flooding or even worse, the dam starts to break. And, you know, in this case, again, even though we have a nice little breathing room here, we're nowhere near out of the woods. There's two more months that they have to deal with this, you know, making sure that the water doesn't go over that emergency spillway again.
Back to our listeners. David has a question in San Francisco. David, go ahead.
Yeah, morning. Two different things. One, there was a book that was written in 1986 about the downtown flood. It gives a lot of really great examples about emergency spillways. But one of the things that's most significant about it was apparently the Johnstown, the dam up there was originally built to supply the early lock and dams like the Erie Canal. And when the railroads were invented shortly after the Erie Canal, that dam was basically abandoned, and it was bought by the super rich and turned into a country club. And they didn't maintain it, and they had an emergency spillway that identical to what's going on in Oroville. It spilled over into Earthen and then just ate away the dam and created the flood. So the issue of privatization of public lands, and then the super rich are not smart enough to maintain the basic engineering of such an important project is a real issue in this.
David, I'm going to hold you there. Thank you. Thanks for that observation. And this, let me just ask Jeff Mount, sort of who in the end makes critical decisions about what needs to be done. We talked earlier that there are a lot of water agencies involved. They may have to foot the bill. Consumers will have to foot part of the bill. But who will make decisions about what needs to be done in order to make sure these dams are safe?
So it's a mix of federal and state are involved in this. The flood reserve and the management of the flood reserve is prescribed by the Army Corps of Engineers. They're called rule curves, and basically it's how you are supposed to operate the dam to maintain that flood reserve. By the way, it takes an act of Congress to change that because it's congressionally authorized. And that's one. And then the other is the Dam Safety, Division of Dam Safety of the state, and DWR. So that responsibility lies with them. There is no private ownership of this. This is a public facility. It's managed by both federal and state standards and owned principally by the state and managed for the state water contractors.
Paul, I want to get back to something you referenced earlier about how we will have to pay for all of this and the tension, as you suggested, between environmental groups on the one hand who don't want to necessarily see more dams built, the impact that that has on the environment and endangered species. On the other hand, the question of not wanting to raise taxes in this state, going all the way back to Proposition 13. So even if there was will, would there be money? How do you assess what the politics of this, I guess, and what may go on now in Sacramento? We have a popular governor. We have perhaps a time when something might happen. What's your assessment of what will have to happen politically for there to be progress made?
Well, there will be attempts to get the federal government to pay for part of it. Congressman Doug LaMalfa, the Republican who represents that area, was at a press conference yesterday saying that he was already talking to the White House and starting to ask for money. I find it actually unusual that President Trump hasn't said anything about this. You know, can you imagine under any other presidency if 200,000 people were evacuated from an area and, you know, there was a major crisis/disaster unfolding? Usually, whoever's the president, whether it's a red state or a blue state, the president says, our thoughts and prayers are with the people of that state. We're doing everything we can to mobilize resources. We're in constant contact with the governor. We haven't heard any of that. And I'm sort of wondering what that means for California in terms of how much this administration is going to go to bat for paying for this. That said, it's California's dam. California owns it. California built it. And so we did pass a water bond, Prop 1, 2 years ago. It was a $7.5 billion bond. A lot of people in Sacramento had been hoping that about a third of that money was going to go to build at least one big new reservoir, maybe an off-stream reservoir in Colusa County called Sites Reservoir. Now there's going to be a question of whether we can use that money to pay for this. The other question is, like Jeff was mentioning, you know, there are 25 million people that get water from the State Water Project. In the Bay Area, they're in the Santa Clara Valley Water District, the Alameda County Water District, Metropolitan Water District in Southern California, which is L.A. and San Diego. So we can raise the rates of all of those people, but the folks who run those agencies don't want to do that. And yesterday at a press conference when we were asking, why did all of you originally fight the effort to armor this spillway with concrete, they insisted it had nothing to do with price and that they were just following what DWR and FERC were saying. But then they quickly said, Jeff Keitlinger, the head of Metropolitan Water District, quickly said, and of course, if there's a flood control fix here, that's really not something that we pay for. So, you know, money is front and center. Nobody wants to pay for this. It's always nicer and sexier and more exciting to build a new project. But having to just go in there and maintain the old stuff is something that nobody wants to pay for.
I want to give our listeners a quick update before we begin to wrap up our hour. KQED news blogger and reporter Dan Brecke is also covering this story. And he wanted to clarify the question that was asked earlier about why were water flows so low last week. And Dan writes, that the California Department of Water Resources actually stopped all releases down the main spillway last Tuesday and Wednesday so they could inspect the structure. So that's part of why the water flows were much lower then. Number of people writing in about Jeff Mount, about how this, the Oroville Dam, is only the tip of the iceberg. The infrastructure of the whole country is terrible. One listener writes, David writes about California urgently needs to invest in infrastructure, renovating and building more and safe reservoirs must be at the top of the list. Sam tweets in about how do we factor global warming into all of this. Give us your thought then about how we anticipate, as you were saying earlier, that what is now seems abnormal is going to become the norm. How do we factor in those climate change concerns given all the infrastructure needs that we currently have?
You know, we're really just at the beginning of that, even though we're the most progressive state in the union on climate change issues. We've convinced ourselves that it is changing and with good science behind it, and now we're in the stage of adaptation, how we're going to adapt to it. I just want to tell you and make clear that a lot of this can be done with just doing a better job of operating what we have. And before we run out and want to spend billions of dollars on new facilities, let's make sure we actually are optimizing the existing facilities.
What do you mean by that?
Let me give you an example. You could make more space for floods if you systematically moved water out of your reservoirs and into your groundwater. Your groundwater is your biggest reserve. It dwarfs the amount of storage that we have in surface water. So start systematically operating your groundwater basins with your reservoirs conjunctively at the same time, and think of them as a single reservoir. And that way you can actually improve your flood performance of your reservoirs as things get weird. And frankly, as climate changes. And frankly, you can just do a better job with what you have. That's the place to start.
Sounds like an important first step to take, and one of many, of course, that we'll have to consider in the months and years ahead. Jeff Mount, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, thanks so much for being part of our program today.
Glad to be here.
And Paul Rogers at the San Jose Mercury News and here at KQED. Paul, thanks very much as well.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lorberg, Jeremy Siegel, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. And I'm Dave Iverson in today for Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.